So we start our second morning session with one talk for this session by Sri Kulkarni about optical afterglows, diagnostics and energetics.
Okay, so why study trends of the optical afterglow? It's a bit loud, I think. Okay. Why study optical afterglow as opposed to at other wavelengths? Well, one is common to all wavelengths. The fireball physics, in particular, are, I think, best studied across all wavelengths. And in fact, over the conference, I'm now realizing that the way we and others have organized conferences by wavelengths is a bad idea for these gamma ray bursts. So I think the next conference, let's not do like an optical guy, a radio guy, an infrared and that, because these sources are intrinsically very broadband. I think we should do it by themes. Nonetheless, as an organizer and a speaker, I'm stuck with this right now. Okay, so the other thing is the optical afterglow is it's a few percent, which is at least in the easily measurable wavelength range, and it's not a small amount of energy. And breaks in light curves tell us about geometry, short of trying to resolve them, which will take us a while before we get there. So those are what I call as fireball physics. The real interest, I would imagine, in the optical is that you can get redshifts. And of course, it's not about getting some silly luminosity functions. It's a bit more than that. But nonetheless, the absorption redshifts of the optical transients, if you can get to them quickly, it's very easy to do. By what I mean that is you don't need large telescopes. Even a 2-meter class telescope can do spectroscopy at 18th magnitude. And there's no reason other than organizing ourselves that this can be done. And I hope with HETI, there'll be a large number of redshifts simply popping out from the absorption against the OT. Okay. And finally, the offset with respect to the host galaxy. This is a way to get clue into the nature of gamma ray bursts. And I think that's a much more interesting question than log n log s and other statistical things which this community is so much used to. And you want to know eventually, now you know how the beast is doing energetically, and you're now doing little things like getting alpha, beta, p's, and now I learned today s, d, and g exponents. That's good. I mean, you know, sort of basic good stuff. But really, you want to know how the thing works. What is it? Right? That's far more interesting. And for that, the optical has a rather unique place in my mind, because it can, the host itself shines not at radio wavelengths, not in the submillimeter, but in the optical. So easiest observational thing is to do this is to get the offset. And so let me give a little historical analogy. People found novae quite some time ago. It took us 100 years to figure out novae are two types, novae and supernovae. And in that time, we found out supernovae at least five types. And much of this progress has not been by doing any population studies, but by actually looking at images and finding some supernovae in elliptical galaxies, and others don't happen in elliptical galaxies. Some are in H2 regions, some outside H2 regions. This is our big clue. It's indirect, but that's all we have. And I won't talk about host spectroscopy. That's the talk by George Jagoski, but certainly a point I want to emphasize again is this is completely orthogonal and complementary to all these studies. Some people think we got a redshift, end of story. I'm sorry, I think they're not still understanding what's really exciting here, and that requires you to get not just this part, which is a thing about trying to understand the location and therefore indirectly the progenitors, but these are other global indicators. So you want to get an HST picture for every burst and its host. You want to know in particular, it'll be very exciting if you find a gamma ray burst and if you take a picture with HST and find an elliptical galaxy. I mean, you know, it's like right away you write a letter to nature. Okay. So, but you need to get star formation rates. Okay, so with this, so it's good to see some humor in this conference finally. Okay, so the morphology and star formation rates do need HST, do need the VLTs and KECs. Okay, there's no substitute. So, But that's okay too. When quasars were found, no one used large telescope time for quasars. 10 years later, a quarter of the telescope time was used to study these objects. So there will be a transition, and we shouldn't be shy about making those sorts of requests. Okay, so now let's get on to basically the advance made by SACS. So I'll start off with the first well-studied SACS burst, 970111, and an optical search was done by Goro Sabal and others, I think about 19 hours after the burst. Well, this shows the problem of trying to do optical work is you really need very good localization. We all appreciate that. As you can see, you know, you start off with a very large WSC error circle, then eventually shrinks down, but all this stuff, because the very first one took a while, and in particular the burst didn't also cooperate, so there's no optical transient found, and that's about at least half the times that happens. We had a different program, which was to look for the radio transients and then rush off to Keck and do this stuff, which we looked, we found a radio transient, and I did write a letter to Nature, but fortunately for us, we withdrew it because this was the source here, which was a BLAC, which was in the original error circle, but not in the final error circle. So error circles are very important, and their sizes must be small. Okay, but the real advance came with the next burst, which is 970228. And here's a picture again showing how much effort goes into localization. And I must say that I have a lot of sympathy for people who do localization. It's like these are the guys who do all the hard work, and then all these other cowboys come in and take over, which is sort of a, you know, bad feeling. But I wish to acknowledge very publicly, without localization, none of us, at least a few of us here, wouldn't be doing this work. Okay, so this is the optical transient, bright. A few days later, it's faded away. And this game, and with this paper, I would say the study of optical transients began in great earnest. Okay, for those of you who are not aware of this, I recommend you Greiner's homepage. It's www.aip.de. It's an excellent place. It's like your one-stop shopping center for gamma ray bursts. Okay, you go there, click on that thing, boom, all the IO circulars, all the GCN notes pop out at you, and it's great. I thought I'd actually go through each of these bursts till about lunchtime, but I guess it's not a good idea, so I'll try to summarize some of this work. Okay, so the ones which are lined here in underlined in blue are objects with either with optical transients, with a couple of exceptions, which I'll touch as I go along. Well, there are a couple here which I don't think I'll get the time, but we have done some recent work, which if there's any interest in that, we can do it later in the afternoon or in the question and answer session of these things. So let's go through some of these bursts. The raw statistics is about 10 by 19, and these numbers are slightly different for different people, where one in particular where they include 1998 BW, which would make it to 20 and all that. Okay, so that's about 50%. Well, but there's a probable cause for failures, that is failure meaning you didn't find the optical transient. Well, there are several reasons. Typically, if you go and look, as soon as the error circles go above 5 arc minutes, diameters, the probability goes down. You wonder why. Well, it turns out there's either a 1K chip or a 2K chip CCD times the typical pixel scale is that number. Okay, so that's an easy one to understand. Late notification, no good, which is why IPN hasn't been all that productive, because these objects, the transients, are very power law. Makes a huge difference whether they're on it 2 hours later or 2 days. A substantial difference, almost a factor of, in this particular case, 3 or 4 magnitudes. Well, the deep south seems to be a rather sad place to work. There aren't too many optical telescopes, so none of the things in the deep south have been identified. Okay, you make some corrections, you have your own sense. It's probably no more than 2 out of 3 is my rough sense of the success of finding these optical transients. It could still increase, but I think there's some genuine bursts which won't have optical transients. Well, the first reason that several people suggested independently was that there could be extinction. Okay, if you have extinction, it kills the optical transient, and therefore and extinction is known to occur in our own galaxy, in other galaxies. So let's look into that. This has been touched, but let me explain. This is a very important issue, so it's important to understand this. The optical depth, and I'll show you a typical dust extinction curve, usually goes as you go to shorter wavelengths, there's more and more extinction. These grains, as you know, have more extinction in the UV compared to optical. In contrast, the X-ray, which is where, in some sense, all the action starts with the X-ray afterglow, or simply the X-ray detection in the wide field camera, has the opposite behavior, because the extinction or the absorption really comes from the photoelectric effect, so it goes as lambda to the plus 3, or nu to the minus 3 is the way we usually remember. So the ratio of these two terms, in fact, as has been noted, is a fairly steep power of 1 plus z, because these things get stretched, so it's 3 plus delta, and delta is typically at least 1, in fact, typically by the higher redshifts you're looking at, it's even larger. As you go to higher redshifts, the same wavelength that we observe translates to a smaller and smaller wavelength, and these extinction curves rise faster and faster. So it's extremely sensitive to this. Okay, it's not a surprise. Of course, it's also centered to how much material you have. So just an example, here's from a paper by, Ralph. Let's take an example. Let's use NH of 10 to the 21 atoms per square centimeter. It's not much. Typically, it's very hard to find a line of sight in our galaxy looking out, and we're not particularly located in, you know, in the center of a galaxy, we're sort of in the boonies, so it's a typical, is a few times 10 to the 20. And 10 to the 21 is, in fact, a typical number. So this, what we used, is not some high, unreasonable numbers. If you take 10 to the 21, look at an object, an optical transit redshift 1, then look in observer's rest frame, R band, the extinction is 5 magnitudes. That's pretty severe. That's a factor of 100. Right? 20th magnitude, we are in. The lots of telescopes we can do. 25th, very few. Or the ones which can do, will not invest that kind of time. Okay, makes a big, big difference just for a typical line of sight. To the extent, I sometimes wonder why are some of these even seen at all? It's almost as if the gamma ray bursts somehow burn off their dust. Okay, good. So then why don't all of them burn off their dust? Okay, well, okay, fine. So here's an extinction curve. The reason I want to show this is there's so many analysis done, reported in the literature. Oh, let's assume delta equals 1. But this is, I'm sorry, but this is being extremely naive, to say the least. And here's a curve from extinction as a function of 1 over lambda. So here's V band, here's U band. You see this famous 2200 angstrom bump, and these are magnitude units. Okay, it's not a linear scale here. So you've got to really know what extinction curve to put. Do we know that? The answer is no. In our own Milky Way, along different lines of sight to these nearby stars, some behind translucent clouds, some behind so-called diffuse clouds, and some behind molecular clouds, or almost that sort of clouds, this answer changes. Okay. How about in other galaxies? It's worse. Things seem to change even more. Here's a typical Milky Way curve, and that's typical meaning it's one of the three that was chosen, LMC, LMC, and SMC. Well, then you could say at high redshift, everything's low metallicity, I'll use SMC. But this sort of naivety is a bit hard for me to accept. But it's easy to do analytical modeling, so why not? Okay, but may not give the right answer. Okay, so let's look at the most famous GRB in this category is 970828. Okay. It was very well localized to start with. It satisfies the little criteria I gave you. And then subsequently localized by HR and ASCA to, in this particular game, to rather high precision. It satisfied rapid follow-up. La Palma got on 4 hours after the burst. We got on 8 hours after the burst. Small error box, as I just said, no OT. Groot et al. Got about 24th magnitude upper limit, and we had about a little half a magnitude fainter, and there's certainly no OT that could be seen, and that sounded like a reasonable, you know, case for dust. The idea that there's dust has been repeatedly enforced upon us through various astro-pH contribution by Reichardt. So I certainly want to give credit to him for emphasizing how you could use deviations from the afterglow model. That is, if you do understand the afterglow model, how it should decay in time, power law, how it should decay in frequency, another power law, any deviations could conceivably be ascribed to dust. But after Peter's talk today, as well as what I'd like to sort of fill in later, is that I'm no longer sure all this business is working. I mean, 6 months ago, I would have said, fantastic, all this afterglow theory is right, because most of us really hadn't paid much detailed attention. But it looks like the deviations are multifold, and dust could just be one of the many causes. Nonetheless, in one particular case, the deviations look simple enough to ascribe to a mild amount of dust, very mild. Remember, 10 to the 21 gives you 5 magnitudes. Okay, the first real example, which I think to me is now confirmed, is 980329. It was not surprisingly first seen in the radio. And only later, despite optical searches, nothing was found. But once the radio ID was made, people went back, and sure enough, there's a faint R-band, slowly decaying object, and a very bright K-band source. Okay, and so the Taylor et al. Concluded in their paper that there is a large amount of dust along the line of sight to the source. Okay, then in a paper by Fruchter, he looked at the optical transient magnitudes, the R and I, and the I band is the one which is the earliest, in this, as well as I think the R band. Not too sure, okay. At least I band from close, and the J and K and R are all extrapolations. The extrapolations assume you know how these afterglows evolve in time and in frequency. Okay. And the reason he had to do this is because people didn't get all these bands at the same time. A very common occurrence, unfortunately, in our little subfield here. Okay, so you have to propagate this, and the propagation is considerable for these two bands because the first data was only 2 and 3 days later. And the idea is there's a big jump, almost a factor of 10. So he suggested that this is simply a Lyman drop, the ratio of 5.4 or something like that. Okay, this hypothesis is a very simple prediction. The galaxy should also have a 2.5 magnitude jump in R minus I, right? Because the Lyman forest is going to apply equally to the optical transient and to our host galaxy. Well, we found this host galaxy because in the hypothesis that this is a redshift 5, the R band magnitude would be undetectable, as noted in Fruchter's paper. So we see it at about 27th magnitude, and we also see it at I band, and there's no indication that R minus I is this factor of 10. Okay, so this, I think, in my mind, settles the issue. We are not looking at a redshift 5 galaxy. What we are seeing is, in fact, a nearby galaxy, and George will give some constraints on the redshift, which is whose line of sight to this particular GRB has rather high extinction, and it only needs to be a few times 10 to the 21. Okay, so now let's get on to breaks, beaming, and rebus. So there are two kinds of breaks. One is a break in frequency, other is a break in the temporal evolution of the light curve, and each of these give you some very interesting diagnostics. So let's start off with the frequency part. The simple afterglow model says if you sit at one frequency, let's say the R band, then this is what you expect to see. First, the flux will go, Okay, this is, at a given time, this is what you expect to see. At low frequency, it's new to the one-third. If you go very low frequency, it's radio, you see self-absorption, which we'll ignore for right now. And then there's a peak frequency after which you're in the optically thin regime with a new to the minus alpha. And this alpha is related to P, the power law index of the particle spectrum that you have assumed exists in this afterglow. Well, if you can actually see this break, you learn something very interesting, and that is the peak frequency is independent of the density and any other sort of astrophysical parameters, and will directly tell you the energy of the burst in this model. So you can see from this equation that all you need to know is measure nu m at a particular time, and then E52 pops out, with these things being, of course, the microphysics that we still don't know. But there's this sort of modeling, you know, is going to give you some idea. And in fact, if you do more detailed modeling that Ralph Wise will touch upon, then you can actually get this independently as you add more and more information. And if you look at F0, which is the peak flux in this model, it remains invariant with time, which means it's the same at all frequencies, then you can solve for the astrophysical parameter, which is the ambient density. Okay. So it's with eagerness that observers look for these spectral breaks, because with the assumption that you have some idea of what these epsilon E's and D's are, you get the energy in to the extent you believe these models. So the one which has happened in the same band, and I'll talk about a slightly bigger case later, is in 97-12-14. Okay, so these are the observations here, the crosses, and then you have to propagate them, because they're not done exactly the same time. But this is not as bad a case as 0329, which had to propagate many days. This is only a few hours in most cases, in fact, in all cases. And then you see that these corrected points, in fact, do not fit a single power law. And this is ascribed to a break. Now, the exact origin of this break is a bit in dispute, unfortunately. Okay, and I hope Ralph will actually tell me which way is leaning now, because when we published a paper, we said the extinction-corrected breaks, which is these points, is in fact out at 1 micron, and we said nu m is 1 micron at 12 hours after the burst, and we got some answers for the energy in the burst, which is ordered 10 to 52 Earths. Okay, maybe I didn't make it clear. So once we get the points of the same epoch here, we need to apply an extinction correction. And I won't go in detail, but the extinction correction is done, unfortunately, by assuming tau goes as lambda to the minus 1 over this range. And these are the extinction corrected points. And they show a clear break at 1 micron. OK. Actually, to do this is a fair bit of work. You may not appreciate this, but it does require organizing a fair amount of telescope time, because by the time you're able to do this, at least with the time at which you can react, these objects are faint. You do need large telescopes to get high quality photometry. So it's not sufficient to say I can detect 20th magnitude. That just means you see a 3 sigma point. The word detect is usually used in that context. To do this sort of work, you need precision value, which means, let's say, 1%, which means you should be able to detect 25th magnitude sources, and that unfortunately pushes you into the several meter class category, preferably at the 2-digit end. Okay. So, the interpretation for this particular break, whether it is nu m or the cooling curve, is up in the air, because we interpret it as nu m. Ralph has a thing on astro pH, which is that's a cooling break, but
I think your interpretation is perfectly plausible.
Okay, so now that he's told me it's plausible, so I'll put this little thing. We say that according to this, the energy should be greater than 2 times 10 to the 51 ergs, regardless to the extent you believe this model, the fireball model. A more comprehensive work can be done when, of course, you go beyond the optical IR bands, as is this rather famous diagram from Galama, Wise, and others, where you go all the way from optical to X-ray wavelength. And, of course, the breaks here are not as, they're slightly more suggestive, I guess is the word. But it shows that in the long term, this is the kind of analysis. This sort of analysis has been done for 0508, and the energy is inferred from this because you have more parameters or more measurements is order 10 to the 52 ergs. Okay, remember that number because we'll return back to 0508. So now let's get into energetics. Certainly the absorption redshifts are easier, especially if you can have rapid response, and Dale Frail will touch upon what from the radio you can now start predicting roughly what is the peak forward shock optical emission, which we have never seen. We have never seen that rise to the top and then a decay in the optical. the only nearest case is 12, 14, in which case is about 40 or 50 microjansky, which is actually a reasonable object to go after for absorption spectroscopy. Okay, so if you can't do that, which we only have two absorption redshifts and four emission redshifts at this point, then you go and, you know, use a large telescope to go and get the host, which, as I said, is valuable in itself, because that's the only way, as far as I know, by which you get global star formation indicators. And there's, again, papers in the literature, oh, this galaxy looks blue, it's forming stars. I mean, so, you know, that's not exactly what you call as modern quantitative astronomy. Okay, so you need this spectra for, if you want to understand this problem in a quantitative sense. Okay, there are two redshifts. I won't bother with showing the spectra, or maybe no one has shown this one. So this is 990123, which is a redshift of 1.6, and George will talk some of the details of the redshift is known to an uncommonly high precision in this particular game, and say something about the absorbing galaxy itself, which is probably most likely the host. Okay, so urged by Bodhan's comments yesterday, I used some high tech and I produced an isotropic E gamma plot, where I plot between redshift 0 to 3.4, what is the isotropic inferred energy release in these objects. Okay, no beaming and all that sort of stuff, in units of 10 to the 51 ergs, and those things actually tell you those particular units. Well, I'm sorry, but I guess usually all I can say is to first order these things, you know, as we see two of these low guys that low redshift, we see two at modest redshift and two more at high redshift. It's a bit hard for me with these sort of things to actually draw profound conclusions. The only conclusion I can draw is, in fact, if we are finding fair number of objects here, it's easy to find objects here from spectroscopy and here, and in between is a great desert. This seems to say that most, even the low nearby ones, are at a rather high redshift, which a conclusion that many have noted. Okay, but of interest to the log n, log s crowd is this, which is L gamma, and again, the arrow means it's not on the same scale, and, you know, I don't have a high-tech PC and all that in my room to do this properly. So these are all, you know, my sense of what is 14 versus 0.2, which is not exactly good here. So, it's a bit hard for me to see, but there are some of you more imaginative, I'm sure you'll draw some good conclusions. Okay, now let's get on to beaming, because the one of the physics that you really want to understand in this game is how much energy is released. If it's more than 10 to the 54, all the theorists will go home, and then we'll get bizarre string theorists and other such types coming into this room. So there's a huge advantage in understanding whether it's more than 10 to the 54 or less than 10 to the 54, and just in determining who attends this conference. Okay. So you've got to understand whether these things are beamed or not beamed. Well, short of resolving them, okay, and there's some things you could do, we heard yesterday a bit, perhaps at radio wavelengths in some very clever way. The breaks in the light curve will tell you about beaming. Now, Peter explained, I think rather clearly, what beaming really does in terms of the light curve. Now, some of you may have not been paying attention, so let me explain again, which is, if you have a spherical blast wave moving at a Lorentz factor gamma, then you're only sensitive to an angle of that sphere, which is 1 over gamma, well-known result. If you have a figure of 8, i.e. a double-sided jet blasting towards you, you're still the same thing. So only when gamma falls below 1 over theta naught, you suddenly start realizing, there is a difference between these two objects. And that happens here, so this is the power law that's going on. It happens at a certain epoch, TB, where the gamma, sorry, it's the same gamma, capital gamma, TB is 1 over theta naught. And there's two sort of variants. One is just geometry, where you realize that the sphere or the emitting object, instead of increasing as you should have expected, in fact stops because there's a hard edge in this, at least in this assumption, and that gives you a delta alpha of 3/4. Now, if this thing starts expanding sideways for whatever reasons, which I won't get in, it'll be even steeper than that. But 3/4 is what you expect from pure geometry, to the extent the hard edge approximation is reasonable. Okay, so 990123, there has been some discussion about beaming. This is not a profoundly new concept. Beaming has been known to exist, I mean jets, in almost every astrophysical context where you have energetic sources. Okay, but why is 990123 so interesting? It's very simple. It's an ideological reason. It's not some data-driven reasons. The ideology here is that this object, if you don't do any beaming, gives you 3 × 10⁴ Hz, which is at that hairy edge of determining who's in this room. And therefore, all of a sudden, this object catapulted into what I learned yesterday as the most famous gamma ray burst. So let's understand what the most famous gamma. So here's much of this data has come, in fact, from our observations. So now we added a couple more points here, and there's one point from the HST data. Okay, so you look at the R-band curve. What's shown here on the top is what we observe. Then we subtract the host galaxy, and George will be showing you some nice picture, because the host galaxy is only half an arc second away, and you do need to subtract that because the OT and the host galaxy become comparable around the time where all this fun is happening. Okay, so when you subtract that, which is what we'll take a look, you can see that if you just did a standard fit to this, it's t⁻⁻⁰, there are large deviations developed by the time you come to assembly about day 20. Okay, so we didn't try to do any fancy one power law going into another power law. We simply said, oh yeah, we'll stop here, looks reasonable, looks, and then we'll have another one. And this delta alpha is 0.55. Okay, but it's useful to mention these things with some error bars, and the error bars in this are 0.4 to 0.7 at the 95% confidence level. Okay, so this delta alpha is large enough to exclude a cooling break. And the reason you think it's a cooling break is, and I must admit, this does bother me, if you do this at K-band, the data are noisier, but nonetheless, formally, if you take the same curve and only leave the normalization open, it doesn't fit, at least in the chi-squared sense. Well, but the problem is, this is not all about chi-squared. I wish we had a few more points here, because this part of the curve is not well determined at all. So it's a bit harder to just say, okay, chi-squared is, we reject the hypothesis. So my attitude right now is, it's intriguing, but I wish I saw a achromatic break, because in this geometrical picture I gave you, it should be achromatic. And therefore, the first thing that you should really look into, which is the more conventional idea, is it's a cooling break. The cooling frequency has passed. The R-band is heading into the K-band. But this 95% confidence level clearly excludes the cooling break. Now, I know that several speakers have alluded to the fact this, oh, this is a very naive way of fitting the data. I think they're missing some point here. There may be this more curvature that as time goes on, this even steepens. That's not the issue. You should look at this delta alpha, and that's an upper limit. The upper limit we expect for cooling break is 0.25, because it takes a while. If the break starts 3 days after the burst, it'll take at least a few days for that to fully complete its turning around. So the delta alpha we compute through this simple asymptotic approach is therefore going to be only smaller than what you expect from theory. This is a trivial mathematical point, but needs apparently elucidation. Okay, so therefore we can exclude. So what I'm saying is the delta alpha maximum in the cooling break hypothesis is 0.25. That's excluded. Okay, with this data, it's high quality, we have lots of points, this side and that side. Okay, in the geometrical hypothesis, this should be 3/4. Maximum value, again, let me stress, if you get a few more data points, it might in fact reach 3/4, or may even reach 1 or 1.1, which is with expansion. That's not so important. So it's not cooling, at least from this point of temporal arguments. Okay, so if you have this, it gets back Martin Rees and all these people back into the room, because the beaming factor, well, Martin is actually clever enough that he can still come back even if it was more than 10 to the 54. Anyway, so it's now, okay, now we're in the qualitative game. Beaming reduction is 10 to the minus 2, hey, 10 to the 52, 10 to the 53, perfectly fine. Well, there are hints there could be two other sources in this category. 980326, noted by Paul Groot and others, that alpha, this is their time exponent, is 2.1, distinctly larger than what you see in other objects. And 90519, that the alpha O, and as we learned today, alpha X, are both quite large. Okay? Could be. I don't want to go into that. Okay. Okay, so let's now go into 970508. This has been popularly advertised, at least in the rough literature, that it is in fact shows a unique strong power law. And I'm just putting up this not because it's, in fact, it is a good work. There are three other such curves I can put up for different groups. And that the idea is you get a single power law, and therefore there's no jets in this object. But actually, if you start reading the paper carefully, which I must admit that it's so confusing that I myself haven't done it as well as I should, then in fact the data are not very good. As an example of that, or the model is not very good, one of the two. Here are the deviations from that single power law. Well, remember, rough rule of thumb, 0.1 mag means 10% error. These errors are reaching 50%. That's pretty awful. Okay, so we have our own self-consistent data, and there's an article by Bloom et al., which in fact has a single power law, doesn't do a good job. Okay, so, but then it opens up a can of worms. How many things do you want to throw in? So obviously, if there is a change in power law here, it is more gentle than in 0123. Okay, so there's a way by which we have estimated the energy in this object, and that's through radio. And Dale, and perhaps later, if Ellie gets a chance, he can go in more details. Here's the radio light curve over 400 days. I find this very impressive that this object lasted so long. And there's a transition, I won't go in detail, it's easy to see in the spectral index and other indicators, at about 100 days where this is relativistic, and then it becomes non-relativistic. Okay, the advantage of becoming non-relativistic is we are on safe grounds. And that is, there's a lot of literature. You can use the non-relativistic data, self-consistent Seddow solution plus self-absorbed synchrotron theory. We can actually get a number that agrees in an internal and in a basic physics sense, which is 2 times 10 to the 50 ergs. So yes, therefore I would say that it is very important for all of us to go back at 0508 and do a really good job understanding whether there's a gradual transition in the time exponent. In which case, there is beaming here, but it's milder than 0123. It's only a factor of 10. Or it need not, it's probably not more than that. Okay. I want to say something about the optical data.
Sorry, Chui, just to get it clear, the reason you say there's beaming here perhaps is now not because of a break you see, but because there is a difference in fluid energy,
yes,
from the radio and from the early gamma rays.
Yes. The early, not only the gamma rays, the early modeling, such as the one you've done and Ellie Waxman's done.
Well, just fairly large latitude.
Okay, so the gamma rays, the early dynamics that Ellie had done to explain this is the Waxman, Kulkarni, Frail paper, to explain the interstellar scintillation and the transition from diffractive to refractive, does require E0 in that equation to be 10 to the 52 Hz, which is an orthogonal thing to what. Okay. And if you just do the E gamma, the usual isotropy, it is certainly not 2 times 10 to the 50 Hz.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to say two things and then end, which is the optical data, I'm afraid, and sorry to say, they're not very high quality. It's not our fault, I think, because these are not controlled experiments. Your burst goes off, you beg and plead with someone who's on a telescope to get data, and they do it in some orientation they want, in modes they want. Okay, now, Dale Frail has the advantage, the VLA is only one instrument, it has no modes. You just go and say, do it at 1.4 gigahertz, and it does it. HST has an advantage, you can't go and change anything there. So here's an example of the ground-based versus HST, which, and I find the HST stuff is remarkable. It's really high-quality fit, and you see these deviations, and you start wondering. So I'm really sort of developing both some sort of pessimism to what we are doing, and with the S, G, and D exponents introduced by Peter into, maybe it's time to do some other stuff, or to do this very differently. And Fiona Harrison will be touching upon some ideas we have, which is we want to build identical instruments, and if you have spare 1 or 2 meter class telescopes, we'll outfit it free for you, in return you get some data on gamma ray bursts. And I think that's the only way to go into a controlled experiment at this point. Okay, so I want to end on a mildly speculative mode. We've been talking about gamma ray bursts coming not from coalescing neutron stars. The actual reasons for this, you know, it's sort of primarily ideological rather than anything real. You know, there's dust, wow, that's star formation. They're always on the coincident, the host galaxy, they didn't have time to eject themselves. But for every one of those things you give, I can come up with a reason and say why the other hypothesis works. But let's go along with this idea. Oh, the other one is, which I forgot, star formation. It's like, my God, stars are being formed at an early redshift. What else did you expect to happen? So it's, but apart from this sort of toy reasons, this has a prediction. If these things come from a hypernova, right? And by hypernova, I mean any one of those models, collapses, hypernova, failed stars, failed supernova, whatever, is that there's a supernova, okay? So roughly there are 10 to the 4 supernovae per gamma ray burst in various cosmologies that can work out. That means, so let me make a hypothesis, which is not a profound one, that the brightest of these supernovae will in fact produce a gamma ray burst because they're the most energetic. And you know, the brightest is not 9898 BW, but it's a very well-studied object. And here's a curve from Galama and others, which shows you the light curve of 9898 BW. Let's look at the absolute magnitude. It's roughly about minus 20th magnitude. Minus 19, but it's not the brightest, okay? I think the brighter one is about a magnitude brighter. But anyway, there are 10 to the 4 I can choose, and I'll choose the brightest, which is a reasonable assumption. Okay, and this says if these things exist, then they should perturb the light curve and better still show up. And if you go at late times, these things have such a rapid exponential decline, this is a model, that it should be even easier. The problem has been that the optical afterglows tend to be bright, so you have to wait. Preferably one of these jet things so that it undergoes the rapid rock-like drop. Well, so I bring to your consideration a possibility we may be seeing a hypernova here. So this is 980326, this is new data from Keck. We have reprocessed all this stuff. It's a long story, which I don't want to go in detail, but this is one of the objects that had a very fast decay in time, t to the minus 2.1, Groot et al. And this circled point was considered to be the host galaxy. We went back to Keck recently. There's no host. Okay. In fact, this is an interesting object in itself. It is the first one with no clear host, but that doesn't turn out to be so restrictive. Therefore, we can now plot this, and my claim is that, forget why this is happening, this happens in another burst as well. At this point, 20 days after the burst, there's a clear, almost a factor of 10 excess. It's true we've seen some rebursting in 05-08, one day after things, 08-08, the X-ray shows reburst factor of 2. Factor of 10, 20 days later, I think the simplest explanation is this guy is peaking 20 days later, it's minus 19. I'll take a distance modulus of 45, which is typical for even redshift of 1.5. Add the two numbers, what do you predict? 25. That's exactly what we see. So I wish, to convince you, we had data for 3 more 10 days apart. If this had shown an exponential decline at 0.025 Mach per day, I think I would have written a paper to Nature. Okay, thank you.
Before we will open this talk for questions and discussion, I want to say you that there will be 3 announcements after the question. So stay in the room for 3 announcements. Please, question.
On the 329.
Yeah.
Now I understand that the redshift 5 is gone.
Yes.
Does that mean that host is back?
The host is there.
The host is there.
Yeah, we have a spectrum and all that sort of good stuff.
Yeah. One question. You mentioned the difficulties in getting good photometric magnitudes from this sort of like campaign or sudden fire drill type thing. But there's another aspect that we didn't mention, I think, and that is the host galaxies are often contaminating the light. Mm-hmm. The example you gave was 970228. And so this angular resolution, that's important too. Mm-hmm. That can't be done from the ground.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But if you look at 0508 and 0228, even well before the OT has approached comparable levels, right? Especially 0508, right? The host is very faint and becomes apparent only much later. It is bothersome that they're not all combining in the same way. And so I think writing these little papers of the GCN, oh, this magnitude, and putting a plot, I think we should actually start comparing the actual CCD data using a common grid of stars and dots at the very least. But I don't think that will still get us into the 1% regime, which is what I think you need to do the kind of work with SGD and dust thrown in now.
A second, second question, and that is, in the 9803-29 case, even if you take away, you were to take away the Lyman limit, the break, it's still, if you fit the whole set of data, the extinction can't arbitrarily, there's a huge drop in the host, in the afterglow between I and R.
Okay.
And that is very difficult.
That may well be. I mean, you could have time-dependent extinction, all sorts of things that various people are talking about. But the simplest answer to me is, you go and look at the host now. Well, that's old story of what...
You didn't show us the magnitudes of that.
Well, George...
we'll see a picture.
And a spectrum, I think.
I can short comment.
Yeah.
Extinction, strong extinction in the galaxy means strong linear polarization. So if there is such a strong extinction for this optical emission, it should be predicted strong linear polarization due to extinction.
The linear polarization for stars in like the Matthewson survey, it's only a percent or two. And of course, if you look very carefully in spiral arms with sort of, you know, not multiple spiral arms, you would get maybe 3 or 4%. But it's not high.
It will actually average to zero. It will look over many, many different...
No, he's talking
in
about
the galaxy. It is a large scale.
Right. No, all I'm saying is you go and look at the stars in a galaxy, and I know the answer. It's in the Milky Way, the kiloparsec away, 1% is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But that's more a little bit more gas than you're talking of right now. But even 1% is hard game here. I mean, then you need to catch it at 18th magnitude to do this.
Okay. Any more questions, please?
Okay, thank you very much again.